You are listening to the Talking Information Center. My name is Jean. Today's date is February 18th, and I'll be reading from the Providence Journal. A City in Mourning. Two people were killed and three were injured in a shooting that took place at the Dennis M. Lynch Arena in Pawtucket on February 16th in what police are investigating as a targeted murder-suicide amid a family dispute. Gunshots rang out at 2:28 p.m. during a President's Day hockey game involving high school students who make up the Coventry Johnson Co-op and St. Raphael Providence Country Day School, North Providence, North Smithfield Co-op teams. Police found two casualties at the scene, including the shooter, later identified as 56-year-old Robert Dorgan, who also went by the name Roberto Esposito. Four more attendees were injured, one of whom died of their injuries in the hospital. The fatalities have been identified as Rhonda Dorgan, 52, and her son, Aiden Dorgan, 23. The shooter was Rhonda Dorgan's ex-husband and Aiden Dorgan's father, and the shooter died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, police said. A Rhode Island hospital spokesperson said those hospitalized were in critical condition as of the morning of February 17th. A video of the incident circulating online depicts more than a dozen audible pops of gunfire and the subsequent reactions of spectators and student athletes who start to duck and rush for cover as the gunshots become more frequent. Witness Chip DiLorenzo, who was there taking photos for the event's hosts, recounted to the Providence Journal that the commotion initially sounded like firecrackers before the arena erupted into pure chaos. He had left the building almost immediately through a nearby emergency exit. "I was tucked in the corner here at the rink taking photos," DiLorenzo said. "All of a sudden, I mean, the typical, you hear multiple firecrackers going off loud, and I didn't count them, but probably 7 or 8 shots, maybe more. People obviously just like started screaming and freaking out. And as soon as I heard that and I saw the reaction, I realized it wasn't firecrackers." Another witness, San Rafael softball pitcher Izzy Souza, told the Providence Journal she initially thought the popping sound was bursting balloons related to the game serving as the final home game for the Blackstone Valley team seniors, before she realized what was happening. She was in attendance to cheer on her classmates with teammate Ella Taylor, who described being trampled in the panic via social media direct message. "I jumped down the stands as I was 2 rows up from the bottom and fell to the ground on top of another high school boy who I did not know," Taylor wrote. "I was then trampled by everyone else trying to get out and was on the floor for about a little less than a minute. I finally got up and jumped the railing of the ramp." At a press conference held at 9:30 p.m. February 16th, Pawtucket Police Chief Tina Goncalves confirmed the shooter's identity and revealed additional information from the ongoing investigation, including that a Good Samaritan had stepped in order to subdue the shooter, that the police had at that time already interviewed more than 100 witnesses, and that they had recovered firearms at the scene. In the hours following the shooting, North Providence Public Schools and the Coventry School Department both confirmed that all of the student athletes participating and present at the game were safe. The Rhode Island Interscholastic League later announced on social media that all interscholastic games will be temporarily suspended out of respect for the victims and to reflect upon this senseless act of violence. The Dennis M. Lynch Arena, an ice skating and hockey rink in Pawtucket, that also serves as the home rink for Johnson & Wales men's and women's hockey teams, is closed to all events as the investigation continues. This is the second major incident of gun violence to take place in Rhode Island within the past 3 months, the state still reeling from the aftermath of the December 13 mass shooting that took place on the Brown University campus. The shooting has elicited responses from several state and federal officials. Governor Dan McKee, who once served as a youth athletic coach himself, encouraged the use of the state's suicide and crisis lifeline by texting or calling 988. He also said his administration is working to provide additional mental health resources to students and families this week. I've spoken to the municipal leaders whose communities have been shaken by this shooting to assure them that they have the state's full support, McKee said. I am praying for Rhode Island. Pawtucket Mayor Donald Graben also issued a statement in the wake of the shooting, thanking the first responders who arrived on the scene. Pawtucket is a strong and resilient community, but tonight we are a city in mourning, he said. We will stand together to support all those affected in the difficult days ahead, and we will keep the public updated as confirmed facts become available. Several sports teams issued statements of sympathy following the shooting, including the Boston Bruins, Boston Red Sox, and New England Patriots. Ice rink shooter troubled by family anger issues. The shooter who opened fire at a hockey game in Pawtucket on February 16th was known for having a short fuse, had faced court action for unpaid debts, and had gone through a divorce after gender reassignment surgery, records and interviews indicate. Pawtucket police identified the shooter as Robert Dorgan, who also went by Roberto Esposito, and who has a family member on the Blackstone Valley co-op team. The shooter died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after wounding multiple people who were in the stands watching the hockey game, leaving two victims dead and three in critical condition. The shooting appears to have been targeted and involved family members, Pawtucket Police Chief Tina Goncalves said. The victims have been identified as Rhonda Dorgan, 52, and her son, Aiden Dorgan, 23. The shooter was Rhonda Dorgan's ex-husband and Aiden Dorgan's father. Here's what we know about the shooter. Court records show that Rhonda Dorgan filed for divorce from Robert Kevin Dorgan on February 17, 2020, after more than 25 years of marriage. The shooting took place on the eve of the sixth anniversary of the divorce filing. Under grounds for divorce, Rhonda Dorgan wrote, gender reassignment surgery, narcissistic personality disorder traits, and then crossed that out and wrote, irreconcilable differences which caused the irredeemable breakdown of the marriage. In 2020, the couple had been living in a North Providence home that belonged to Rhonda Dorgan's father, police records indicate. Dorgan went to the police, saying that their father-in-law had threatened violence and said, there is no goddamn way a tyranny is going to stay in my house. A tranny is going to stay in my house. Public records indicate that Dorgan moved away from Rhode Island later that year, registering to vote as a Republican in Jacksonville, Florida in 2020. The divorce was finalized in 2021. By 2022, Dorgan was living in Maine, according to court records. The Providence Journal is using they-them pronouns to refer to the shooter, whose gender identity is unclear at this time. The Dorgan couple had the same last name before they were married in 1992, court records show. An obituary for a relative suggests that their fathers, who also had the last name Dorgan, may have been related. Records show that Dorgan was facing lawsuits over unpaid debts in Rhode Island and had similar claims filed in Florida. They also faced lawsuits for unpaid child support. They also experienced discord within their immediate family. They accused their mother of assault in a February 1, 2020 incident and received an order of protection, court records show. The assault charge against Dorgan's mother, Joanne Dorgan, was later dismissed. They had a clean criminal record in Rhode Island, accruing a simple assault charge as a teen and driving on a suspended license a few years later, both of which charges were dismissed. At the time of the shooting, Dorgan was employed at General Dynamics Bath Iron Works, a main facility that builds U.S. Navy ships. We extend our deepest sympathies to the victims, their families, and all those affected by this tragedy, David Hench, a spokesman for General Dynamics, said. Ryan Fisher, who worked with Dorgan at Bath Iron Works for 7 years, said that Dorgan got short-tempered a lot and something always seemed off. Still, the news of the shooting came as a surprise, he said. It rocks your world a little bit, said Fisher. Dorgan was an electrician at the shipyard who worked as a cable puller because they had muscle, said Fisher. He said that Dorgan went by the name Roberta and seemed insecure and shy, but would dress in inappropriate clothing. Fisher emphasized that he doesn't have a problem with transgender people, but said it seemed odd that Dorgan would show up wearing high heels and short skirts in summer. How the hell could you wear high heels in a shipyard, he asked. Another former co-worker, who asked to remain anonymous, said they were also surprised by the shooting, adding that just days earlier, Dorgan was showing off photos of their ex-wife and kids and talking about how much they loved them. The co-worker said that it was his first interaction with Dorgan, who had a reputation for being an odd bird and real big into guns. He said that Dorgan described their ex-wife as my princess and gave no indication that they were divorced. That was on Friday, February 13th. On Monday, February 16th, Dorgan killed 2 people and injured 3 in what police say was a targeted act of violence against their family. Social media accounts under the names Roberta Dorigo and Roberta Esposito, which appear to have belonged to the shooter, paint a picture of a troubled individual. The day before the shooting, they responded to an anti-transgender post on X, formerly known as Twitter, saying, "Keep bashing us, but do not wonder why we go berserk." In one post, Dorgan suggested that coming out as a transgender woman had led to marital discord. "My wife said she hates the person who stole her husband," Dorgan wrote in 2018. "I think it's extremely important to take special care of those who stand by us. Listen to what they are going through for our sake." Dorgan espoused conservative views, expressing support for President Donald Trump and white nationalist Nick Fuentes, while also objecting to anti-trans comments made by other right-wing figures such as Alex Jones. "I'm hyper-conservative, hyper-Christian, and a hyper-gender dysphonic trans woman," they wrote in 2018. Person with measles takes a flight. Guidance from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is crystal clear. If a person has measles, they should not get on a plane. Still, the agency said it has conducted an unprecedented number of disease investigations since 2018 of people who took a commercial flight while contagious with measles. News broke February 6th that a person with measles arrived late in the evening of January 29th to Milwaukee's Mitchell International Airport on a Southwest Airlines flight from Phoenix. The person continued to Walworth County and is now isolating there, state officials said. The traveler set off a scramble to notify those on the plane or in the airport who might have been exposed to measles, which is one of the world's most contagious diseases. It can hang in the air for up to 2 hours after an infected person passes through, and up to 9 in 10 people exposed will become infected if they are not protected by vaccination or having already had measles. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which includes the CDC, did not respond to a request for comment. But guidance from the agency, published in 2024, outlines how it typically works. When the CDC is notified of a contagious passenger on a flight, it requests the flight manifest data for people seated around the contagious passenger, who is called the index patient. The manifest provides names and contact information. The CDC determines the risk of those seated on the plane depending on the disease. For measles, an example seating chart from the agency's website shows that people who sat in the same row, in the 2 rows ahead, and in the 2 rows behind the index patient should be contacted. That includes seats on both sides of the plane and the middle grouping of seats if there is one. In addition to people who sat close by, all travel companions of the index patient should be contacted, according to the CDC, as well as guardians of children younger than 2 who were seated on adult passenger laps. These children could be too young to be vaccinated and would be at extra risk, the agency's guidance said. In the recent Southwest Airlines case, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services was notified by the CDC of 20 Wisconsin residents who are considered close contacts of the infected person because of where they sat on the plane, spokesperson Jennifer Miller said. After such a notification, the state health department works with local health departments to notify the people who may have been exposed. 6 of the 20 Wisconsin residents potentially exposed to measles on the flight live in Milwaukee, the city health department announced February 9th. In a news conference February 10th, Milwaukee Health Commissioner Mike Tordantidis told reporters the health department has made contact with those residents and the majority of them have received the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, which is about 97% effective at preventing infection. People who are exposed but have either received the vaccine or have previously had measles are not required to quarantine. Those who have not met that criteria need to quarantine for 21 days after their last exposure. Regardless of whether they are quarantined, those who are exposed should monitor for symptoms until February 19th, Tordantidis said, and notify their physician if they begin to feel ill. Early measles symptoms include high fever, cough, runny nose, and red watery eyes, followed by a rash starting on the face and hairline and spreading over the body. They typically emerge a week or two after infection. City Health Department staffers are looking for signs of the disease in wastewater using a public health tool that is able to detect measles. If measles is found in southeast Wisconsin's wastewater in the coming days, which would indicate it is spreading in the area, Tortatitis said his staff will go back to the 6 residents to initiate enhanced contact tracing. Other passengers on the airplane or just in the airport with the infectious traveler could be at risk, according to A.J. Sethi, a professor of population health sciences at UW-Madison, who studies infectious diseases. There's no magical wall that prevents someone farther than 2 rows away from the infected passenger from breathing in virus particles, he said, especially if the passenger walked around the plane. He emphasized that the probability of breathing in the virus declines the farther people were sitting from the infected passenger, and that planes do have air filters that would eventually clear virus particles. But air also circulates around the plane, he said. If it was an office or classroom and someone was there within 2 hours with measles, you assume the whole place is a place of risk. No one's going to say, "Were you in the northwest corner?" Sethi said. But this is just one of those situations. When you're doing the investigation, time is of the essence. It's hard to have the resources to contact everybody. You have to first contact the people at greatest risk. In a CDC report on a case in which a person with measles flew into and out of Denver International Airport in May 2025, 9 Colorado residents subsequently became infected, including a passenger sitting 5 rows from the original infected person. 5 of the 9 were not on the plane, became infected after being in a terminal or concourse with the infected person. Outside the plane, people who stood close to the infected person at the gate or on the jet bridge would be at risk as well, Sethi said, though in this case, that would not likely have occurred in the airport. That would likely have occurred at the airport in Phoenix, not Milwaukee. Sethi noted that although health officials have reached out to only a select number of passengers on the plane, they've broadly publicized the flight number and times the infected person was at the Milwaukee airport. That should also provide others the information they need to know if they are at risk, he said. Judge overrules Trump order to remove displays. Michael Cord was ecstatic when he heard February 16th that a judge had ordered the reinstatement of displays commemorating the enslaved people held by President George Washington. A federal judge in Philadelphia on February 16th issued a stern rebuke of the Trump administration's desire to disassemble and disassemble historical truths when it has some domain over historical facts. The administration does not control historical facts, U.S. District Judge Cynthia Roof ruled. The dismantling of displays at President's House in Philadelphia is part of a broader effort by the Trump administration aimed at ending DEI programs and gender ideology extremism, and restoring truth and sanity to American history. A year ago, references to transgender people were scrubbed from Stonewall National Monument's website, and earlier in February, a pride flag was removed from the site. Other signage at national sites relating to Native Americans' displacement and climate change have come under scrutiny as well. Citing George Orwell's famous novel 1984 and its fictional state's motto that ignorance is strength, Roof sided with the city of Philadelphia, Washington's home in the early days of his presidency. The city had said that a 1948 law and a 1950 agreement between the city and the federal government required the National Park Service to get the city's permission before making changes to the site. Signage identifying 9 enslaved people and describing life for 18th century black Philadelphians was dismantled January 22nd by federal workers acting on President Donald Trump's orders. The President's House parcel at 6th and Market Street, steps from the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall, is where Washington lived when Philadelphia was the U.S. capital, and records show that he kept enslaved people there. Cord, who worked for 2 decades to recognize the contribution of those enslaved people, told USA Today that he was just leaving a rally in support of the displays when he heard the news. This comes as a surprise for a number of reasons, not only that it happened, but that it happened on the date that it happened, on President's Day, he said. USA Today reached out to the National Park Service and the Department of the Interior, but did not immediately receive a response on the federal holiday. Cord said he and his group, Avenging the Ancestors Coalition, are optimistic but also pragmatic, as the federal government has 30 days to file an appeal. Roof's ruling did not give a date for the restoration of the displays, and Cord, an attorney, said he expects the Trump administration to request a stay pending on appeal, allowing the signage to remain in storage.